You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.
Hello, once again, I'm Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, bringing you episode 5 of Weed All About It. I call today's episode The Trifecta, because this podcast is made up of 3 different stories with a single payoff, a more educated weed industry. First up, Glenn Squires, CEO of the Washington Grain Commission, explains the grain industry support for the Snake Columbia River system in testimony prepared for delivery at a hearing that wasn't that kind of hearing. Next, you'll hear Christy Kirkpatrick, director of the Whitman County Library System, describe a program that will yield dividends for future generations, and you can help. Finally, yours truly will describe my influences, how I got here, and why I'm reaching for podcast stardom. But first, let's hear what Glenn Squires would have said at a hearing if he'd been given the opportunity. You see, years ago, when I covered federal hearings as a reporter, they were highly structured affairs where person after person addressed a panel of officials, or maybe just one individual, about why such and such an issue was either to be supported or rejected. Those hearings had their drawbacks, however, including getting hijacked by extremists more interested in press attention than studying an issue. Partly to address that possibility, the hearings held on the Snake Columbia River system recently weren't hearings at all. They were more like educational briefings, with opportunities to submit testimony through a scribe or write your own. Glenn Squires came ready to testify at the hearing about the importance of the Snake Columbia River system to Northwest wheat farmers, but like I said, it wasn't that kind of hearing.
You don't have to be a liberal or a conservative to agree U.S. infrastructure, including ports, highways, and bridges, needs a massive upgrade. The planned outage of the Snake Columbia River system beginning December 12th is part of that infrastructure improvement. And as a Corps of Engineer officer said recently, it's so much easier to navigate repairs when the system goes down on our schedule than having to go out when it wants to go out. Civilization and its needs, including its infrastructure, are not something to destroy, but to continue to improve. Man and nature can work together. They must work together. I believe that technology applied to challenges can render solutions, and the last 20 years of dam operations proves my argument. In order for me to list all of the benefits of the Columbia Snake River system, my testimony here would require 3 hours rather than 3 minutes. In my position as CEO of the Washington Grain Commission, I can say that dams are an essential piece of infrastructure for farmers to get their wheat to market. More than half of the wheat barged on the Snake River moves through one of the 4 Snake River dams. In the absence of barging, nearly 140,000 trucks might be required to move that grain, damaging our already fragile highway system. The economic vitality of Washington's grain industry depends on trade. Anticipating an Asian boon for our commodities, grain companies have poured $500 million into Columbia River export terminals and barge unloading capacity. In a world where being green is a political force, the fact barging is the most energy-efficient and environmentally friendly method of moving cargo should not be forgotten. Neither should the fact that hydropower is a non-polluting, renewable resource, which is essential for integrating the abundant wind energy portfolio now found in the Northwest. Mankind is capable of marvelous feats of engineering. I believe the series of dams and locks on the Columbia and Snake River are among their number. Since their construction began in at Bonneville in 1938 and ended at Lower Granite in 1975, every aspect of dam operation has been refined and improved. Current fish passage numbers speak for themselves. As you study how best to operate this tremendous Northwest resource, do not forget to investigate all direct and indirect impacts, both economic and social, that are part of the river system's operation. Include all impacted users, including ports, carriers, cruise boats, elevator operators, recreationalists, and others. This is not the time to tear down America. This is the time to strengthen America and its infrastructure, to prepare for a world that will be even more competitive than the one that exists today.
Are you proud of your rural heritage? Do you have photos of grandparents, civic events, farming operations, or anything else which reveals the history of Eastern Washington? Then the Rural Heritage Collection being pursued by several rural counties and Washington State University wants you. The Whitman County Library District is a leader in helping develop a photographic record of the not-too-long-ago past. I recommend all of you Google the Whitman County Library and click on the Rural Heritage window on the right-hand side. Seeing people and places from a familiar past is an experience which touches your heart. I spoke with Library Director Christy Kirkpatrick about the project.
Rural Heritage Collection is a collection currently of over 4,000 historic images from all across our region. And it is an online database that you can access from our website or from a bigger collection called Washington State Rural Heritage. And it's been great through, hundreds of community partners now, including our small town museums, individuals, families. We've collected great photos that we've put online for everybody to access.
Washington State University is overseeing the effort as part of a larger database that will ensure the images submitted are kept up to date and move to new formats as technology changes. I asked Christy if people could print the photos.
Some are so old they're not copyrighted, and others the person contributing the image has retained the rights to. And so what I would advise you to do is when you go onto our website and find an image you like, if it is owned by somebody, you just give us a call and we ask the owner for permission for the person to use it. A great example would be WheatLife has used a number of our photos. And so in doing such, we just give credit to the person who contributed the photo. And to my knowledge, we've never had anybody not want to have their photos used for a number of purposes. I've seen some businesses have called and enlarged those images to hang within their building. We've been published in actually a number of other publications besides WheatLife. So it's just been a great collection.
Although I found it fun to electronically flip through the pages of the collection, Kirkpatrick said there are a number of ways to search the collection, including by family name.
There you can search the databases in all different ways. You can search by subject. Snowstorms is a great one this time of year. There's some great old photos of trains trying to get through huge snowdrifts. Or you can search even by family name. We're adding more and more historic family photos. You can search by town, which is always fun. See your community, see communities that maybe don't exist anymore. It is just a fabulous database. The other thing I wanted to mention about it is it started as a way to preserve photos that were at risk of being lost. And so we really reached out to some of our museums that maybe that don't have the best preservation methods because they are small town museums, or to people who would find boxes of photos in their home that were yellowing, cracking, that sort of thing. And so it really is a wonderful way to preserve our history for our children and grandchildren.
Now, what you've all been waiting for, Scott Yates, that's me, director of communications and producer relations for the Washington Grain Commission, comes clean about his history, his influences, and why he's reaching for podcast stardom. For those who didn't have the pleasure of interacting with the balding, ponytailed reporter who began working for the Capitol Press in late 1986, let's just say I wasn't like any agricultural reporter who had covered the beat before. Some said I was aggressive, others that I lacked finesse. Several years after I'd started, one individual came up to me after a meeting and wondered loudly what the A in my Scott A. Yates byline stood for, and then suggested an alternative. For the record, the A stands for Addison, not the other thing. I worked for the Capitol Press for 22 years, and I've worked at the Washington Grain Commission for almost 9. Over the years, I have met and interviewed thousands of people involved in every level of agriculture. I think it's safe to say I know a lot more about you than you know about me, which is what this particular podcast is intended to remedy. My earliest memory, I was probably 3, is of sitting in a device which was essentially a 360-degree table with wheels. I was supplied with crayons and paper and placed in a seat through a hole in the center. I couldn't get out on my own, but my little feet could maneuver across the linoleum of the kitchen floor, getting closer to objects that excited my curiosity, without ever quite reaching them. I have since wondered whether there is a connection between that early experience and becoming a journalist. Able to observe, but not able to interact, pretty much sums up a reporter's modus operandi. I am the last of 4 children, 2 older brothers, a sister, and myself. There is a lot you can infer about a person by where they fall in the birth order. Oldest are most likely to take charge and want things their way. Middles are more even-tempered and willing to compromise. Youngest are, well, I prefer to call them sensitive. I grew up in Boise, Idaho until I was 12 and then Reno, Nevada until I was 21 and had graduated from the University of Nevada with a degree in journalism. My sensible fallback profession if writing the great American novel didn't pan out. I traveled to Fairbanks, Alaska, and applied for a job on the local newspaper, the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, while I made ends meet driving taxi 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. during the end of the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. After a couple of months, the newspaper editor called and said, "I wasn't going to offer this job to you, but then I thought, why not?" The job was serving as a receptionist for the newsroom. It was 1976 and women's liberation was still in its infancy. As my editor's hesitation indicated, the idea of a man doing a woman's job was unusual enough that he almost hadn't considered me. He understood what it meant, and at the time it was no easier for me to wrap my head around it. A receptionist. But I was smart enough to understand that getting my foot in the door was the first step to getting the job I wanted. And though my male ego had to be subdued, I was only a receptionist for 5 months. Several years as a reporter in Alaska were followed by a couple of years with the Peace Corps in Africa, followed by a master's degree in writing, followed by arriving in Spokane, where I raised 3 daughters, but alas, not a marriage. When I took the job with Capitol Press, I may not have known anything about agriculture, but as a journalist, I had the tools to learn. I asked tough questions, not because I thought they were tough or with deliberate intent to wound. I asked questions because I didn't know the answers. I believe one of the requirements of a good journalist is a natural curiosity combined with a desire to tell stories. Agriculture provided an array of opportunities to satisfy my curiosity, since my knowledge of the industry was pretty much limited to the aisles of a supermarket. As for telling stories, I think we'll all agree agriculture is a place ripe for the picking. But those first few years covering eastern Washington and northern Idaho agriculture were tricky. I can't tell you how many times I began sentences with a disclaimer. I know this is a stupid question, but it was a cumbersome way to gain knowledge. But I often tell people now I wish all city slickers could have had my experience as an agricultural reporter. It would make everybody a lot more understanding. When it comes to understanding something, there's the data, but the data isn't everything. I think to really understand a process, you've got to know the people. And it was from being involved in the Washington Agriculture Education Foundation, otherwise known as Ag Forestry, that I received that opportunity. There were 30 of us in Class 13, which met during 1991-92. It was an eclectic group. There was an environmentalist, a couple of lawyers, state bureaucrats, organic farmers, nurserymen, and large and small conventional farmers. While I became friends with most of my classmates, it was with two individuals, a hog farmer from Farmington and a wheat farmer from Washtenaw, with whom I formed the closest bond and, as it turns out, my clearest window into agriculture. Putting people together helps you find your commonality, or maybe the word is humanity. Ag forestry didn't alter my worldview or my politics, but it did temper my perspective with on-the-ground realities of living a resource-based life. I learned that rules and regulations were more than words on a piece of paper, and that partnering with Mother Nature is fraught with perils non-farmers can't begin to appreciate. All this by becoming friends with a couple of farmers. It's doubtful anybody could tell the difference in my reporting before ag forestry and after ag forestry, but I knew it was there. Where I had once covered agriculture from the outside in, I was beginning to cover it now from the inside out. It wasn't just that my conscience now featured two farming friends on either shoulder, though that helped. It really came down to developing an appreciation for the lives these two men and their families had chosen for themselves. A funny and instructive story before I end this musing. When I was a reporter at Capital Press, I purchased my retired schoolteacher mother a subscription so she could keep up on my workaday life. I thought I had done a particularly good job on a complicated story, and in one of our weekly phone calls, asked her if she had read it. Yes, she said she had read it, but she didn't understand it. After that, I always tried to write stories my mother would understand, and I still do. I once called myself a reporter, or when I was trying to impress people, a journalist, but really, I was a purveyor of information. In that sense, I remain a purveyor of information today. Starting this podcast is intended to provide information you wouldn't get anywhere else, but I also want to entertain and maybe even create a bit of community among those of us in the Pacific Northwest who hold the wheat crop we grow, market, and promote so near and dear. There is a power in smartphones to bring us the sounds of agriculture. This hasn't been done before. I want those of you listening to record and email in your own sounds of agriculture and rural life. Engines revving, coyotes howling, an implement rattling, a baby's first words, the sound of seed being poured into a hopper, thousands of dry heads of wheat brushing into each other in the wind. The possibilities are endless. Our email is waai@wagrains.org. That's waai@wagrains.org. Or go to our Facebook page at Wheat All About It to find out the details of a contest we're running with prizes for the winning sounds in various categories. Now here's a sound that I like. My daughter and I singing the song I wrote called Special Treat. The words are on our Facebook page. Come on, I'm sure there's a lot better singers and musicians than me. Hit it, Chloe.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.